looking forward to getting our summer work program on track. More than anything, it's good to have a permit in hand and ready to move forward.
The Pebble Mine Project gets a land use permit. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage officials unveil big new plans for public transportation.
If you live in an area that has a lot of these frequent routes, you can survive without a car.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
After months of delay, the Pebble Limited Partnership was granted its land use permit by the state's Department of Natural Resources today. But taking into account the concerns raised through a public comment period, DNR is adding more oversight to Pebble's activities and adding some new stipulations to the permit. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Andy Mack is the commissioner of Alaska's Department of Natural Resources, which grants the miscellaneous land use permit needed by companies like Pebble to operate on state lands. This one, says Mack, was different than the rest of the thousands processed annually.
It's a very unique process. A lot of what we have done is new, including the requirement that a permit application like the one that we saw from Pebble last October would be subject to a public comment period.
That followed a lawsuit challenge brought by Nunapta Alukastai, which ended with a settlement that the public could weigh in on Pebble's state land use permit requests. DNR took in more than 2,000 comments last fall on this application.
Many of them were substantive, and many of them were Alaskan, and many of them were from the Bristol Bay region.
And many of the comments allege Pebble has left a mess at some past exploratory drill sites and that state regulators haven't been stringent enough. Mack is not saying that's the case, but the state did agree to add more inspections, added a $2 million bonding requirement, and shorten the length of time the permit will be issued.
Miscellaneous land use permits, or MLUPs, can be issued for as little as 1 year or for as long as 5 years. Based on the amount of interest and based on the need in our minds to be more proactive and get into the field and be looking at some of the concerns that were raised, we decided and we issued this permit for 1 year.
Groups opposed to Pebble say they did not get everything they were hoping for, but did cheer the administration for the stipulations that were attached to Pebble's 2017 permit.
This is really the state holding Pebble to a tighter standard, which they should.
Kim Williams is the executive director of Nunapta Alukastai. She and others like United Tribes of Bristol Bay and some sport fishing groups have voiced concern about prior lack of oversight and a rubber stamping of land use permits for the controversial project they say could threaten Bristol Bay's salmon habitat.
No, our state hasn't, I believe, held them to that a standard of watching them and inspecting them and making sure that they go back in and close things up that are not supposed to be. You know, I mean, so it's good for us.
It's been several years since Pebble has done much more on their mining claims than what's called care and maintenance of the old exploration. But there are more than 1,300 boreholes from past work, some of which were identified as problematic during an independent inspection paid for by the United Tribes of Bristol Bay. Findings from that inspection were the basis for many of the public comments submitted to DNR. Pebble takes a different view of their operations, says company spokesman Mike Heatwall.
Many of the issues that were raised in the public comment window we take great exception to, primarily because the technical foundation for it was not very strong. We firmly believe that we're in compliance with the terms and conditions for the permit to operate out there. Our work is sound. We take our responsibility very seriously and we'll continue to do so.
DNR also acknowledged that there was no evidence that any of the concerns raised by the UTBB report amounted to violations of Pebble's permit. The company has already put up the $2 million performance guarantee now required by the state, and Heatwall says they will welcome the added state inspections and other changes as they push the project along.
We're looking forward to getting our summer work program on track, and we're committed to continuing to run a compliant operation. More than anything, it's good to have a permit in hand and ready to move forward.
Right now, the permit issued by the state does not authorize any new exploration at the Pebble claims, nor has the company yet requested that. However, in a press release issued Tuesday, Pebble CEO Tom Collier wrote that the company will be working this year to prepare the project for the permitting phase. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
After hours of debate on the State House floor, an oil tax credit bill is on its way to the Senate. House Bill 111 passed primarily along caucus lines. Proponents say it will stabilize the state's tax regime and get Alaska a larger share of the profits from its oil. Opponents say they were rushed in reviewing the latest version of the bill, and they say that increasing taxes on the oil industry when prices are down will drive away the industry Alaska relies on for most of its money. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more from Juneau.
Alaska is one step closer to getting another oil tax credit overhaul. Representatives in the State House voted Monday to send a contentious bill over to the Senate. And, facing stiff opposition to a tax hike from Senate Republicans, the House Finance Committee that put out the latest version of the bill tied it to a Senate-approved permanent fund bill. They added language to that permanent fund bill that says it will only pass in the House if the House's version of the oil tax credit bill passes in the Senate. The latest oil tax credit overhaul drew a lot of criticism from opponents in the House who say that it goes beyond fixing a cash-for-credit system that many say the state cannot afford. Wasilla Republican Delaina Johnson and many of her colleagues in the House minority say they didn't have enough time to look over the newest version of the bill. It was put out on Friday.
To take on this bill without understanding the consequence, having it sneaked in at the last minute, having less than 12 hours to put in amendments, it just doesn't make good sense.
In its current form, the bill would get the state out of the business of offering tax credits that can be exchanged for cash for work done on the North Slope. The state's delayed payments on those tax credits has resulted in a tab that will reach about $900 million this year. That's a provision that lawmakers on both sides of the aisle agree with. Proponents of the bill say that it's a better idea to reform the tax credit system into something the state can actually afford rather than continue along with credits that the state has to delay paying. In the new bill, companies would be expected to carry their losses until they're producing oil and owe a tax liability to the state. Then they could use those losses to offset taxes. A new addition to the bill cuts off a per-barrel credit given for oil production. But it also drops the base tax rate for the North Slope by 10%. If the oil industry investment stays the same and oil prices don't change dramatically, the Department of Revenue forecasts that the new oil tax credit system could raise oil income to the state for at least the next decade. According to its projections, the state could bring in $130 million more in revenue by 2019, all the way up to $475 million more by 2027. But there are a lot of caveats to that projection, and the bill isn't assured to pass in its current form. Opponents and industry representatives have repeatedly argued that the state changes its oil tax credit regime too often. Alaska's Revenue Commissioner, Randall Hoffbeck, says the political infighting and instability in the state's oil tax credit system go hand in hand.
What we need to do is get to a tax structure that enough people say that is good enough. We're going to leave it alone, and we're going to leave it alone for a long period of time.
Hoffbeck says having a predictable tax system is more important than the actual amount of tax revenue the state brings in. Opponents also question the idea of raising taxes on the industry at a time when oil prices are low. The oil and gas industry has shed thousands of jobs since record high employment in 2015, and it's projected to lose another 1,500 this year. Fairbanks Republican Steve Thompson says a tax hike will cause more people to lose their jobs.
Oil companies have said they're going to be laying down drill rigs if this is what we're going to end up doing, because we will not be profitable.
But many in the Democrat-led majority caucus say that industry will not walk away from Alaska, citing other states and countries with higher tax rates and the state's high-quality oil. Fairbanks Democrat David Guttenberg says Alaskans should look at what the multinational oil companies say about Alaska in their shareholder meetings. He says Prudhoe Bay will remain an attractive place to invest.
Part of what they have successfully conveyed to this legislature, which has always bothered me, is that their shareholders are more important than our people.
Guttenberg and 20 other legislators in the House are betting that the industry can handle the pressure. But there isn't a lot of time left in the regular session for the Senate to decide what it's going to do. Next Sunday is the 90-day session limit, But without a fiscal plan for the state or a resolution on oil tax credits, lawmakers will likely continue to meet. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
When Senator Mike Dunleavy left the Senate majority last week, he knew it meant he would lose some of his official positions of power. The Wasilla Republican found out what the fallout is likely to be today. The Senate Committee on Committees recommended that he lose two committee seats. The Senate is likely to make the changes tomorrow. If the Senate approves, Dunleavy would lose his seat on the powerful Senate Finance Committee and his seat as chairman of the Senate State Affairs Committee. Palmer Republican Shelley Hughes will replace Dunleavy on finance, and Anchorage Republican Kevin Meyer replaces Dunleavy as chairman of State Affairs. Kodiak Republican Gary Stevens will replace Shelley Hughes as the education chair. Dunleavy left the caucus in order to oppose the budget. He called for maintaining permanent fund dividends and making deeper budget cuts. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an unusual sea creature washes up on an Unalaska beach.
It's kind of one of those things where it's like, oh, that's awesome. But no, this is a good little field trip.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The body of a man has been recovered from Turnagain Arm near Beluga Point. Alaska State Troopers say the man has been tentatively identified as 36-year-old Kevin Thibodeau of Anchorage, who was the subject of a search last week. Troopers last Wednesday night took a call that a man had fired shots at Beluga Point, a scenic pullout on the Seward Highway south of Anchorage. Anchorage police shut down the highway for more than 12 hours as officers tried to contact the man. When he wasn't found, a warrant was issued for Thibodeau's arrest. Officers on Thursday morning found a gun and other evidence, but could not find Thibodeau. The body was recovered yesterday and transported to the state medical examiner for positive identification and an autopsy. When President Donald Trump's blueprint budget came out in March, it included eliminating funding for the Sea Grant program for next year. But Alaska's congressional delegation doesn't want it to go away. Today, Senator Lisa Murkowski introduced a bipartisan Senate resolution showing support for Sea Grant. Murkowski co-authored the resolution with Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley. It acknowledges Sea Grant plays a vital role in many communities nationwide. Last week, Congressman Don Young signed a letter of support with members of the House. In a town hall meeting in Petersburg on Monday, Young said the program receives a good return on investment.
The Sea Grant program is dear to my heart. In fact, I had the head guy into my office the other day. We'll continue to fund that. It works.
Sea Grant helps fund research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The programs help track the economic vitality of the seafood industry and measure the effects of climate change, making up dozens of projects across Alaska. In the coming months, Congress will decide Sea Grant's funding for next year. The White House has asked to cut Sea Grant's funding for the remainder of this year, too. That budget needs to be approved by the end of April. Today, officials in Anchorage unveiled an overhaul of the municipality's public transportation system. It's the first big redesign of the troubled bus system in nearly two decades. And as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, planners will spend the next 6 months preparing residents and visitors for major changes.
Inside a cavernous maintenance shop filled with dusty buses awaiting repairs, Mayor Ethan Berkowitz steps up to a wooden podium flanked by colorful new transit maps.
The reason why we have to have change is because the old model of providing public transportation wasn't working the way it should have been.
Berkowitz cites declining ridership over the last 30 years as evidence of the system's shortcomings. The administration spent the last 18 months working on a redesign that aims to draw in more riders.
If we could effect the kind of change that allowed us to serve more people better, we would attract more riders and be of greater community value.
To do that, the bus system is basically putting more resources in the places with the highest density of riders and cutting back on coverage in more sprawling sections of town. The new plan includes routes that have fewer stops with more frequent buses, speeding up commutes. And those kinds of trade-offs and perks are the puzzle pieces that transit planners like Bart Rudolph are working with as they figure out how to improve bus service with the same budget.
It's probably the biggest change in the last couple decades. Introducing high-frequency transit in Anchorage has never been done. We've never talked about 15-minute frequency routes. If you live in an area that has a lot of these frequent routes, you can survive without a car, and I don't think you can say that with today's system.
Rudolph gets excited talking about some of the particular changes designed around riders' needs, like more frequent, faster trips to the airport until 2 a.m., when the flurry of red-eye flights begins tapering off. But Rudolph has to be a booster for the overhaul, because during the next 6 months, the city needs to essentially retrain thousands of bus riders.
So we have quite a robust marketing campaign. It starts with blanketing our transit centers with new signage. We'll have new route maps on the buses. We'll have radio, TV ads. And then we'll roll it out in October, so you'll be hearing a lot from us.
The funds for all that marketing and promotion come from federal dollars. John Weddleton is pleased with how the plan turned out, but has had concerns. He's an assembly member representing South Anchorage, but owns a business across town in Spinard. Both of those areas are due for big service changes compared to what's in place now.
I think the concept was a coverage concept. How much area can we cover? And they said, well, let's try this ridership model. Just focus on places where riders are really riding it. And that's something they've been talking about for years, and now just making that happen.
Early drafts of the plan withdrew service from much of Weddleton's district, as well as outlying communities like Eagle River and Chugiak, north of the Anchorage Bowl. But as planners met with community councils and collected more than 1,000 comments from the public, they reintroduced scaled-down service to more spread-out parts of the city. And they're pulling standard 40-foot buses off of small neighborhood streets, replacing them with 20-foot minibuses, like the kind used for airport shuttles. You can see maps of the new routes on our website, alaskapublic.org. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
According to federal data, about 1 in 4 high schoolers in Alaska doesn't graduate, giving Alaska the 6th lowest graduation rate in the country. But what about students who do graduate? State economists in the Alaska Department of Labor tracked thousands of Alaska grads and published a Where Are They Now in this month's Alaska Economic Trends.
We use the permanent fund dividend records in order to match all the different data sets together.
Yancey Lee led the research. Of the roughly 7,000 people who graduated from Alaska high schools in 2005, he was able to match about 6,000 of them to data from the State Departments of Labor and Education. This study differs from others because it looks at people who graduated from Alaska high schools, whereas census data looks at all Alaska residents, whether they graduated in state or not. Of the class of 2005, 37% went on to finish college within 10 years. That's 2-year or 4-year degrees.
It's difficult to gauge whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing. When you look at census numbers, we're not very different than what's expected. You know, college education isn't for everyone.
The data show that prior to graduation, students who don't go to college earn more than those who do. But after graduation, it flips. Those with degrees start earning more at a faster rate. 3 years after graduating, they're earning about 16% more. The top 10 employment industries for those with some or no college are roughly the same. College graduates, on the other hand, have a much wider range of occupations. Lee says the Department of Labor hopes to run the study again as more data becomes available.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
A more normal winter across much of Alaska bodes for more normal river breakup conditions this spring. National Weather Service Alaska Region Climate Science and Services Manager Rick Toman says after 3 years of generally below normal snow and ice and above normal temperatures, Alaska was more on track with historic averages this winter.
And with the forecast of increased chances for cool weather the rest of this month over the eastern interior and the Yukon, and somewhat above normal over western Alaska, there's the potential for this long, protracted snowmelt and breakup.
Toman says the forecast for a warmer spring in western Alaska and somewhat cooler conditions to the east also would ease breakup along the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers.
Melting and weakening the ice faster than normal in the west, and it's a slower process in the east, so you reduce the risk that there'll be this big flush of water coming down the rivers and then running into solid ice.
Toman cautions that the outlook is based on modeling and that there's always potential for a sudden big warm-up like the one that resulted in a major ice jam flood at Eagle in 2009.
That is a possibility. There's no sign of any big warm-up like that on the horizon, but the end of April is a ways away yet.
Breakup timing is forecast to be normal in northern Alaska, 1 to 3 days early across the state's midsection and 2 to 4 days early in southern areas. King salmon fishermen in southeast Alaska will see a significant reduction in their harvest this season. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced on Monday that trawlers will be allowed 100,000 fewer fish than last year under management guidelines negotiated under the Pacific Salmon Commission. And it's unlikely that trawlers will be able to make up the difference in their fallback species, chum, if forecasts prove correct. KCAW's Robert Woolsey attended the spring troll meeting in Sitka.
Trawlers were clearly discouraged by the announcement, but it was not unexpected. King salmon, or Chinook, are not returning to their home rivers in southeast to spawn in sufficient numbers. 4 of the region's 6 major Chinook-producing rivers are forecast to fall at or below escapement goals this summer, continuing a downward trend that began in 2012. King salmon trolling is divided into 3 seasons, spring, summer, and winter. With only 155,000 kings to catch over the entire year, southeast trawlers could have an especially short summer season. Grant Hagerman is the regional trollfish biologist for ADF&G.
Well, a lot of it depends on where we're at after winter and spring close. It could be that we carry tens of thousands of fish extra in, but yeah, we could be looking at somewhere less than 5 days.
Summer king trolling opens on July 1st and sees around 900 boats on the water. Last year, summer kings averaged about 12 pounds dressed and brought in an average of $5.10 per pound. Managers try to limit trawlers to about 70% of the summer harvest in that first opener. Sitka-based troller Eric Jordan has co-authored a proposal to the Alaska Board of Fisheries to further restrict the July king harvest to 60%. Jordan's hope is to see better value on the kings caught later in the summer.
The fish are worth more, they're bigger, and the catch rates are less in August, so please do not end up catching the whole quota in the first few days of July.
Winter king trawlers get the best value for their harvest. As of April 10th, trawlers had landed almost 20,000 kings, about half of them in Sitka. The price for winter kings hit $10 a pound in January and has remained high. Managers expect the strong harvest to continue through the end of April, when trawlers will have landed about 45,000 Chinook. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
In southwest Alaska, Kuskokwim River subsistence fishermen should receive more fishing openings for Chinook salmon this summer than they had last year. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Final harvest figures show about 37,000 Chinook were harvested from the Kuskokwim last summer. That's about 10,000 less than managers had allocated for subsistence catch. Now, managers estimate that this year's Chinook run will be similar, so there can be more openings.
The benefit of hindsight is we understand what opportunity we provided and what that harvest equated out to. So given that the forecast is relatively similar, if we're trying to get a similar harvest objective, then we can move forward providing more opportunity.
Aaron Potter is a fish biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The agency predicts a Chinook run size of 132 to 222,000 fish along the Kuskokwim. Like last year, the numbers are below the historic average. State and federal managers remain in what they call conservation mode and will be taking a cautionary approach to fishing openings this summer as they try to rebuild the salmon stock. The number and length of openings will be determined in season based on the run size entering the Kuskokwim. The Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group has suggested that state and federal managers close the main Kuskokwim stem to Chinook fishing from May 20th through June 11th. During closures, managers could still set aside times for fishermen to use live release gear, like fish wheels, beach seines, hook and line, and dip nets, as well as 4-inch or smaller mesh gill net to target non-salmon species. Potter says Kuskokwim tributaries will have different restrictions from the main river. In non-salmon spawning tributaries like the Gweek and Johnson Rivers, any size gill nets will be allowed. In tributaries where the salmon do spawn, like the Kwikset, Kizaralik, Tuluksak, and Aniak Rivers, no gill nets will be allowed all season. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
What has 8 arms, 2 tentacles, and washed ashore on a beach in Unalaska Monday night? A more than 6-foot-long squid. Zoe Sobel from Alaska's Energy Desk has more on the unusual visitor.
Carlin Enloe has lived in Unalaska her entire life, all 22 years. And this beach squid is a first for her.
The only time I've ever seen something this big is down in the Seward Sea Life Center. They have a giant squid that I think they actually caught up here or washed up. Up here.
Enloe found out about the squid on Facebook and made her way down to the beach after 10 p.m.
It's kind of one of those things where it's like, oh, that's awesome. And you think, oh, I can rush down right now. Or did that person, you know, is it a photo from a couple days ago? Did I already miss it? You never know. But no, this is a good little field trip.
The chance to see the beach squid has brought out a steady stream of Unalaska residents, from on-duty police officers to parents with kids wiping the sleep from their eyes. But how rare is it to see a big squid on the beaches in Unalaska? According to Sea Grant agent Melissa Good, it's more common to see beached whales or other marine mammals.
My guess would be because they are living near the surface, where large squid are going to spend the majority of their time deep sea. So it's less likely that they would wash up.
Good thinks this squid is a robust clubhook squid. Unalaska is in the middle of its natural range, which stretches from Southern California to the Gulf of Alaska through the Aleutian Islands. But seeing this species in the wild is pretty rare. As to why it died, Good doesn't know. But less than a day after it washed up, it's gone. She thinks eagles and foxes made a meal out of it.
It's become a food source. I like calamari. Other things probably like calamari, too.
From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Elizabeth Jenkins, Caroline Halter and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.